This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Marwan Muasher, who is Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment. He formerly served as Foreign Minister and Deputy Prime Minister of Jordan. His new book is The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism. Marwan, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you for having me.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Amman, Jordan, and raised there until high school.
And looking back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world?
Well, certainly, you know, all parents do. I cannot say that they shaped all my thinking. I went from there to the American University of Beirut in Lebanon, where I think the beginnings of shaping of my mind took place.
And so is that where you got your degree?
That's where I did most of my undergraduate work. This was a period in the early 70s that was a very turbulent period. No period is calm in the Middle East, but it was a particularly turbulent period. But it was a university where liberal values were installed, where critical thinking, issues that I talk about in my book, but issues that we were not used to as kids growing in a rather conservative place in Jordan. And that's where my ideas started to shape.
What was that clash of cultural viewpoints like? I mean, was it jarring? Was it easy to adjust because of the university setting?
It was a setting where certainly it's an American university, but it's an university that was placed in the Arab world, had a lot of Arab professors, and a place where different ideas from the Arab world, in fact, clashed and coexisted at the same time. A place where, the Palestinian movement was very strong, the Lebanese movement was very strong, a place where all of these ideas were allowed to, be debated, We had a speaker's corner where every week people from different political outlooks would come, students, of course, and would voice their views. And even though the views, like I said, were very different, it was the first time that I started understanding that you have to accept and tolerate other points of view.
Did that experience give you insight into the cases where people are shocked, traumatized by this clash of values and ideas?
Well, I was not used to, debating different points of view, and I was very young, but still this was my first time where I had to face the fact that not everybody thinks the same way. In high school, we kind of were raised to think that this is the case. And a time to question your own values, your own truths, truths that you regarded as absolute until then, and start to think, to realize that there are many truths in this world and that you have to explore all of them.
Your career started in journalism?
Actually, I'm an electrical engineer by training. Even my PhD is in electrical engineering. But I started early on to feel that this was not my calling. And so while I actually did work in electrical engineering and started teaching and doing research in electrical engineering, but almost concurrently, I started writing a political column as a side job, if you will, in Jordan. But, gradually I started feeling that this is where I wanted to go, that I was getting more fulfillment from doing this than from doing engineering. And I made the shift in a very gradual way.
This background as an electrical engineer, inform your understanding of the importance of science for the Arab world in the future?
Well, I think it did, and it did in many ways, not only what you just described, but also feeling that you need to move away from rhetoric, you need to move away from flowery language and actually put some content into what you're doing. And, you know, later on I became spokesman of the Jordanian delegation to the peace talk, and I found that when I did that, that was of particular use, that you need to rely on information, that people wanted information. They did not want just flowery language and rhetoric. And even though I was not trained as a political scientist or a journalist, I still found that that emphasis on content rather than form actually was of use.
If one looks at your distinguished career, you've been involved in a number of important roles, and within those roles, really important tasks from working toward peace in the Middle East, toward coming up with a plan for your own country, being foreign minister, opening the embassy in Israel after the first movement toward peace between the Arab world and Israel. I like to ask my guests, what, looking back on your career, what do you see as the skills and temperament involved in doing what you did?
Well, I think you need, I was, as you said, involved in information, in policy making, in international affairs. One of the first skills that I've learned is never lie. Okay, sometimes you cannot say the full truth in what you do, but what you cannot do is lie. And if you do, I think you lose your credibility quite fast. Another temperament is to state your views calmly. We live in the Middle East, in a region where people have very, very strong views about issues, any issue, and where people sometimes mistake, the strength of the argument with the level of your voice. You raise your voice, you lose your calm, and you really lose the argument. And so how to be credible, how to present facts, and how not to lie, and how to do that in a calm and reasonable way, I think are key skills.
If you look at many of the initiatives that you've been involved in, there must really seeking peace in the region, seeking economic development for your own country, working in such a volatile region, there's an awful lot of frustration, isn't there? I mean, that in other words, projects, whatever your efforts, are not completed, they don't reach the fruition that you wish for. Talk a little about that, because I guess patience helped there. Patience helps, but what else?
It is a lot of frustration. You know, I spent more than 20 years of my career trying to contribute to peacemaking in the Middle East, and we don't have much to show for it. So I keep joking that after doing that, now I'm working as a consultant on the issue. But with the frustration also comes a sense of mission. You feel that you're not just doing a job. You feel that you're contributing, or trying to contribute at least, to the future of your country, to the future of the region. And that's quite fulfilling, even if the rewards are sometimes lacking. I find it at least fulfilling in that sense. And I found helps keep you going, even when the results are not always what you hoped they would be.
In your career and in all your different assignments, words seem very important. The shaping of the language by which you explain. Talk about a little about your training there, because you must have really mastered those skills.
Well, I'm not sure I did. I was trained as an engineer, and in engineering, and you see things in black and white, you see things in bits, and nuances are not really there. And yet in the field of politics, nuances and words sometimes, you know, are more important than the actual substance. What I did find is that, as I said, I tried to compensate my lack of training as a lawyer, as a political scientist, by presenting facts and presenting them in a clear way, the way engineers do. And I found out that actually people appreciate that, that they do want facts, that they want to, you know, take away the rhetoric a lot of times and understand what is going on. I cannot say that I always succeeded at that. I still, to this day, feel that I actually needed more formal training in political science, in law maybe, and I tried to compensate that by reading a lot.
Your new book is called The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism. What was the audience you had in mind in writing the book?
I had different audiences in mind. Certainly the Arab world as my first audience, the youth in the Arab world as a particular audience. And in fact, I dedicate the book to the youth of the Arab world who I said revolted not against their parents, but on their behalf. And that's how I feel. That's a quote I got from Lisa Anderson, a friend of mine. And certainly a Western audience as well, who, in my view, tend to look at the Arab world in very simplistic terms and tend to judge things prematurely, romantically at times. It was called an Arab Spring, prematurely in my view. It is now being called an Arab Inferno, again prematurely. This is a historical process that is unfolding and will not unfold in a few years. And I'm trying in the book to explain, one, why it took place, but two, how to help shape it from an awakening towards pluralism and towards democratic societies.
You write that there needs to be, that what has happened needs to be contextualized within a coherent intellectual framework. And you really start with history, even in your title, because the book is called The Second Arab Awakening. So I guess another important skill here is historical study.
I strongly believe that we need to understand what is going on through contextualizing it within a historical narrative. There is a first Arab Awakening. In fact, a very seminal book in Arab history is called The Arab Awakening, a book written in 1938 by an Arab who tried to chronicle a movement which started as an intellectual movement in the 19th century in the Arab world, in places such as Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, and other countries of today. A movement that started talking about the need for Arabs to get rid of Ottoman rule and later of colonial rule and to gain independence, to expose themselves to the West, etc. And that movement later found its way into popular movements that demanded independence and actually achieved it. Where the Second Arab Awakening is different is that it started as popular movements, not intellectual movements. But so far, do not have any intellectual framework. In other words, these movements know what they are against, you know, authoritarian rule, injustice, etc. But they're not very sure about what they are for. And so far, beyond the general demands for social equity, justice, these have not been movements so far that have articulated a clear vision for the future. I'm trying to contribute to that debate, as at least.
And when one looks at the history, you conclude, and historians conclude, that there were limits to what was achieved. I mean, it was a step in the right direction, but the focus was really on first the overthrow of the Ottoman Empire, which was not an Arab empire, but which ruled the Arab world, and then secondly, the colonial powers, that replaced the Ottoman Empire. What was the particular form of the failure that is an important lesson for today?
The first Arab Awakening was basically a battle for independence. And the battle was achieved, was won. Independence was achieved in the Arab world. And then things stopped there. That is my principal argument with the first Arab Awakening, is that no country in the Arab world, no force post-independence, gave any attention to the issue of pluralism, of democracy, of putting in place institutions that would ensure stability through democracy and pluralism, and, of course, prosperity at the same time. My argument in this book is that if the Second Arab Awakening is to be successful, it cannot stop at throwing authoritarian governments out. It must lay the ground for pluralistic societies. And it must understand that this does not come easy or quickly, and that there are a lot of things that need to be done in the Arab world before we arrive at these pluralistic societies.
Now, the First Awakening really set in place a structure that still haunts us today. And intellectually, what was going on and with what followed, there was a swing between a kind of nationalism and, on the other hand, a pan-Arabism. So that was the sort of the global perspective on what became a failure.
Yes, pan-Arabism, particularly post-independence, was basically the solution to all the problems of the Middle East. Nasser in Egypt raised a very famous slogan: "No voice is allowed to rise over that of liberation." He meant liberation of Palestine. And what basically was meant by that is that all the energies of the Arab world have to be channeled towards one objective and one objective only, which is to regain Palestine from Israel. No other effort was made to put in place, democratic institutions, neither in countries like Nasser, which were seen as progressive in the Arab world, nor in the conservative monarchies, if you will, or systems of the Arab world as well. No force, and they were all secular at the time, no force was able or was interested in doing that. We then moved, Harry, to a period where the only alternative, when that pan-Arabism concept was shattered in 67, when the Arabs lost the war with Israel, we moved to a period of, if you want, political Islam, where Islam became, the solution to all the problems of the Arab world, where people flocked to Islam because it constituted an alternative to the ruling elite, which failed in providing either freedom or bread to people. Today, because Islam was artificially kept out of the system, of political systems, and could promise a lot of things to people without putting these promises to the test. Today, in 3 short years, after political Islam came to power in certain Arab countries, it has actually done more to weaken itself by being in power than Arab countries have attempted to do by excluding it from power for the last 50 or 60 years. And today we're moving to an era, in my view, where neither the secular forces nor the religious forces in Arab society have been able to put food on the table in an effective manner. So neither pan-Arabism nor Islam are being today seen as the solution. We're, I think, entering a phase where delivery is going to be the solution. Whoever creates jobs, whoever creates growth is going to be successful, not based on their ideology, but based on their performance.
Talk a bit about the sustaining of the system that occurred after the First Awakening, because that becomes very important for understanding the difficulties we're having now. So we got a series of autocrats in place, and they built groups that supported the existing regimes. Talk a little about that, because there's an important trade-off there, support for the system by certain elites as a payback for supporting the autocrats.
Unfortunately, the period of Arab states gaining their independence almost coincided with the discovery of oil in the region. Oil is, of course, seen as a blessing by many, but it actually, in the Arab world, has not just been a blessing. It has also been a curse. Oil has basically killed productivity and created patronage systems that you talk about in the Middle, in the region. When money literally grows on the ground, people don't have to adopt productive systems. And countries have adopted patronage systems where they created layers, leaders created layers around them that basically, made use, were given privileges in return for their loyalty. In oil-producing countries, but also in countries that depended on oil-producing countries, whether for grants or for jobs for their people. And my country is one of them. These layers became so ossified that when leaders later on started contemplating reform measures, these layers would be the first to stand against any reform measures so as not to lose their privileges. We've seen that very, very clearly in a place like Egypt. We've seen it very clearly in a place like Tunisia. And it is no wonder that people in the end felt that all the economic reform efforts that were made in these countries ended up going not to people in general, but to the cronies around the regimes. Because economic reform was attempted without a parallel reform, a political reform process that ensured that when abuses took place, they would be addressed in an institutional way. This is what has happened in the Arab world. What is needed is a move away from these rentier systems that depend on rent, towards merit-based systems that depend on productivity so that they are able to answer people's needs.
Now, another part of this structure, and I'm walking you through this because I think it's important for understanding your proposals later for where we should go, is the strange relationship with political Islam and the extent to which that relationship, and I want you to describe it, played into satisfactory dealings with outside powers on the one hand, but also positioned the political Islam to be the best organized, the group with their ear to the ground when the Second Awakening came?
Well, precisely because, first of all, we need to understand that political Islam is not monolithic. And that is, I think, something that sometimes is missed, particularly in the West. When we talk about Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah or Hamas or the Muslim Brotherhood, these are all quite different from each other. Most of political Islam belongs to a peaceful movement called the Muslim Brotherhood and its offshoots. The rest, have employed radical means, sometimes violent means, to advance their views, but they remain a minority in the Arab world. But even with the peaceful movements, the Muslim Brotherhood, Arab countries excluded them from the system and excluded them from running for elections in most countries. In Jordan, they were not. As a result, these people, focused their efforts on building constituencies on the ground rather than on elections which they could not contest to start with. They created social networks. They were able to provide health services, food services to their constituencies. And they were also able to present themselves as the cleaner group of people if they come to power. And because, as I said, they were excluded from power, they could afford to promise people a lot of things without putting these promises to the test. When the secular forces, the pan-Arab discourse, if you will, failed, particularly after 67, political Islam found a very ripe environment for people to support it. Not necessarily because they always agreed with the ideology, but because it was the only alternative to a shattered group that basically ruled the Arab world uncontested for a very long time.
And to further the point, this position, political Islam or Islamic groups like the Brotherhood, to be more involved with the granular landscape, doing social welfare work and filling some of the gap left when the state was not responsive to people's needs?
Without question. It filled that gap by the state when it was not responsive. Secular forces, on the other hand, even when they were allowed to operate, and in most cases they were not allowed to operate, tended also to be elitist, lecturing from podiums rather than working on the ground and building networks as the Muslim Brotherhood did. And that, of course, contributed a great deal to the success of the Brotherhood once the uprising started.
And for the leadership, the rulers in many of these places, the existence of the Brotherhood was a flag that could be waved to the West as a justification for the ongoing system in the Arab
Absolutely.
Country.
Absolutely. Leaders presented themselves as the lesser of two evils. They attributed activities, positions to the Brotherhood that they themselves were practicing. I mean, for example, political Islam is accused of not giving women a role in political life. Well, secular forces that have ruled in the Arab world have not also given women any prominent role in political life. Arab governments have accused the Islamists of wanting to come to power and never to relinquish it, which might be true, but it's these same forces that also came to power and did not relinquish it. So the Islamists were being held basically to a higher standard than all the systems that were prevalent in the Arab world anyway.
Another component of this, which you don't really talk about in the book, is the fact that what we had was military regimes, basically. So the military becomes an important facilitator of the structure, and one that the West wants to support, first for reasons of anti-communism throughout when there was movement toward peace with Israel, supporting those regimes that would support, especially Egypt, that would support the peace treaties with Israel.
Yes. I mean, not, of course, all Arab countries have military regimes, but the point is taken. The West focused on stability and thought that stability was the number one objective in these regions, and therefore they looked the other way when it came to domestic challenges and domestic reform in these countries. Of course, stability was induced by brute force. It was not a natural stability. People were not content with their governments. But because political space was closed and these countries often used their militaries and their security services to impose a state of artificial stability, the West, you know, was fine with that. As long as some of these countries cooperated on the Arab-Israeli conflict, cooperated on oil and on other such issues. Of course, this is not sustainable, and the Arab uprisings have shown this 3 years ago, that whereas this arrangement has worked for decades in the Middle East, it could not be sustained indefinitely. And today, the Arab world has a challenge to go back or to move forward to natural stability, stability that comes about from new social contracts between citizens and their governments, not stability that comes through brute force.
So one other element that strikes me in this is that this system, the structure that we've just described, furthered to the extent that the West let it be or supported it, created myopia about what was actually going on. And this is especially true in a point that you made earlier about the complexity of political Islam, so that the West was really incapable, especially the United States, of seeing the diversity that could be that was present in political Islam.
Yes, I mean, look at even the term moderate Arab states. It was applied to countries like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and they were seen as moderate because of their view on the Arab-Israeli conflict. So the definition of moderation only extended to a country's position on the Arab-Israeli conflict. If it was pro-peace, it was seen as moderate. But it was not extended to its view on domestic reform issues. I mean, no, today, I mean, very few would consider Saudi Arabia to be a moderate country on reform issues, certainly not Egypt, and we have seen what has happened in the uprisings. My argument is that moderation needs to extend across all areas and not be limited to one's position or a country's position on the Arab-Israeli conflict. And that... let me stop you.
Okay. So, well, because we will get all of this out of you, but there's one other element that I want to raise as we then set the stage for your proposals, and that is this, that technology really played a role in awakening the young people. Talk about that, because that seems to be central both for the initial excitement and hope, but also technology doesn't address the issues that you're raising throughout your book.
No, but technology did play a role. I mean, we should not exaggerate the role, as internet penetration in the Arab world is still relatively low, but it did play a role in at least two important ways. One, it provided exposure to the outside world, where there were no filters by governments, no censorship, and people were both, exposed to outside views as well as being able to put their own views on the internet without going through a filter. And it also played an important mobilization role in the initial phases of the uprisings in Egypt and Tunisia. Social media was certainly used to mobilize people, to tell them where to go, to tell them where protests were being held, etc. As internet penetration gets larger, you know, this is a youthful generation that is going to be, that is not going to suffice with what their parents accepted. The Arab world is a very youthful region. 70% of Arabs are under 30 years of age. So the future truly belongs to them in every sense of the world. And with technology becoming cheaper and, like I said, internet penetration becomes larger, that can only be positive towards the evolution of more pluralistic societies.
Now, when you look at the Second Awakening, you come forward with a set of proposals that, in essence, is calling for a third force that is respectful of diversity and pluralism. Talk about that, because that is, in essence, what you're saying about the failure of the First Awakening and the modern history up until the present.
I think that... Both the two major forces in the Arab world, whether they were secular or religious, both of them have failed, basically, in answering people's needs. Both of them have relied too much on ideology and too little on providing real solutions to people's economic problems. That is why I place a lot of hope in the youth, in third forces that are both, you know, believers in a civil state, but democratic at the same time. The problem that we are seeing today in many places in the Arab world is that secular forces might be liberal at times, but not democratic. They believe in selective democracy, democracy so long as the results are to their liking. And we have seen this very clearly in Egypt, where today the secular and elements aided by the military are behaving in the same way that they have accused the Islamists of doing last year, being very exclusionist, rounding all their opponents in jail, etc. Third forces must be secular and democratic at the same time. This is not a discourse that is easy to develop and will not develop quickly. But in my view, it must be the operating system. Pluralism, inclusion, respect for diversity must be the operating system if the Arab world is to transition to prosperity. Pluralism does not ensure or guarantee success, but it's a necessary component for it. And I, in the book, talk about several issues that the third forces must pay a lot of attention to, because the experience of new political parties emerging in new democracies across the world, not just in the Arab world, has not been a very easy experience. Emerging political parties all suffer from a set of common attributes. They tend to focus around people and not programs. They tend to worry about elections only and not building grassroots support. They tend not to be well-financed and to have problems financing their activities. They all suffer from this, and therefore people look at them with a lot of skepticism. And in my book, I talk about the need to develop clear programs, the need to develop grassroots organization and not worry too much about elections at first, the need to consolidate. You cannot, every 10 people after a transition think they have all the answers to all the problems of the country. But you cannot operate in a place where you have 100 or 200 political parties. So consolidation is important, and you need to be patient. This is not something that is going to emerge overnight. There are no shortcuts to democracy. And one very, very important issue that I hope we will talk about is education, the need for a new educational system.
So your argument really is talking about two elements. One is cultural attitudes, respect for diversity, respect for pluralism. Another is institutional, in the sense of really creating parties on the ground over time that are responsive to people, that raise money, that recruit people, but also, I guess, the hope for governmental institutions that make all of this click.
Yes, absolutely. Institutional work is a must, because democracy is not just about elections, of course. You have to create institutions, judicial, legislative, you have to have a free media, you have to have respect for human rights, all the pillars make for a democratic culture. But the cultural aspect is equally important. You cannot have these institutions develop successfully except in a culture that accepts the diversity and regards it as a strength and not a weakness. The Arab world is a very diverse region, ethnically and religiously. And yet that diversity is not reflected in the educational system or in people's views of each other. We're all seeing the sectarian divide today in places like Syria or Iraq or Lebanon or elsewhere. Unless you have an educational system that teaches the values of critical thinking, of acceptance of other points of view, of tolerance, of questioning authority, of regarding truths as relative and not absolute, unless you create that culture, which, once again, cannot be done overnight, there is no hope for democracy to flourish in the region.
And your background, which we discussed, really makes you sensitive to the failures of the educational system And the insights that the UN report from 2004 pointed to in describing the Arab world and the changes that needed to be made. Talk a little more about that, because it's really important. You can't create this culture unless the educational system is changed, and that is not increasing the quantity of money going to the system, but also the values that are inculcated.
That UN report, really, which started in 2002 and was written by Arab writers, identified three major gaps or challenges facing the Arab world: a political gap challenge, a governance challenge, a women gender gap, and an information gap, a knowledge gap, if you will. And that is the knowledge gap that really I address in the book, The Need for a New Educational System. It's a disaster that today not one Arab university ranks in the first 500 universities of the world. It's a disaster that a country like Greece, a country of 10 million people, produce more books than the whole Arab world is able to produce. I mean, there is a serious knowledge gap that needs to be addressed. And it's not in terms of quantity, as you said. In fact, the Arab world spends 5% of its GDP on education, close to what OECD countries spend, about 5.5 to 6% of their GDP on education. So it is not a matter of a lack of money, but it's a matter of the proper focus. All that money goes to building new schools, putting computers in them, which are all important and needed activities, but very little goes towards, you know, the content of the educational system, the training of teachers, the introduction of skills like critical thinking, research activities, communication skills. All that, of course, was done in an attempt to create docile societies that would not challenge their authorities, whether secular or religious. What the result has been, of course, is totally the opposite: the creation of frustrated societies, not able to compete in the marketplace, and therefore people who ended up going to the street.
Somewhere in your book, you say that the present is an occasion for thinking through all this, because what is emerging is a battle of ideas in the Arab world. And I guess the question becomes, with this set of alternative ideas that both, in a way, describe the failure of the present systems and point to the future, where do we find the ignition? Once the ideas are on the table, what do you see as the factors that will make them happen?
We have today an element which was not there before, which is the Arab street. And the Arab street today is not content with accepting whatever their authorities give them, whether secular or religious. You look at a place like Egypt, and you find an Arab street which brought the Islamists to power and then went against them in a short year or two after they failed to deliver. You see an Arab street which went against Mubarak because he failed to deliver, and like I said, brought the Islamists in. That's a factor that was not there before. And that is what gives me hope. In other words, the battle for ideas today have a test, and that test lies with the Arab street. If people are able to translate these ideas into effective programs that answer people's needs, they will be successful. If they worry about ideology and slogans that don't mean much, they will fail. And that is something that I think is new in the Arab world, and that gives me hope that from now on we have some performance indicators and some criteria with which to judge whether people are actually delivering or not. Before, we did not have that.
Let's compare two countries, Tunisia on the one hand, Egypt on the other. What do you see as as positive elements in one or the other that point toward a brighter future where there's hope for your agenda?
These are two neighboring countries that followed two completely different paths on their way to transition. Both are offering what to do right and what not to do in the path. The successful model, of course, is Tunisia. And why? Because they followed a path of inclusion. Because they understood that in a transition, you need all forces of society to take, to participate, and you cannot rule by exclusion. And what they did, they formed a coalition government. They worried about the constitution as a first step towards bringing, if you want, something similar to a Bill of Rights where everybody is assured a place in the system. They, after three very difficult years, were still able to agree on a constitution which today is by far the most forward-looking constitution in the Arab world. Full parity between men and women, upholding the principle of peaceful rotation of power at all times, upholding the principle of the right to believe or not to believe. And this is accepted by the Islamists as well as by the secular forces. You compare that to Egypt, where they behaved in a very exclusionist way, both of them. So when the Islamists came to power, first of all, they worried about elections first and not a constitution first, which meant that whoever won the elections at that particular point in time wanted to dictate their views of how society should be like on all of society. The Islamists attempted that through writing a constitution which did not enjoy the consensus of all forces. As a result, they did not deliver. The secular forces today that pushed the Islamists out with the help of the army are unfortunately doing exactly the same thing, behaving in an equally, exclusionist way. And as long as people behave in a zero-sum game, the sum will be zero. These are two very clear models of what happens when you adopt inclusion and pluralism and what happens when you don't.
And how do you account for Tunisia's capacity to move in this direction? Is it the pre-existing situation? Is it experience as they went through their revolution?
There are a number of factors. Tunisia is a small country. Tunisia is a country where the Islamist opposition actually has been traditionally, historically, more moderate and more forward-looking and more accommodating than the rest of Islamist movements across the Arab world. It's a country that did have a middle class. It's a country where, interestingly, the labor unions have always been a strong factor. And so they did have a third force, if you will, one that did not belong to either the ruling elite or the Islamist opposition. So a number of factors that converged to produce the successful model that Tunisia did. That's okay. I mean, the fact that Tunisia has unique characteristics does not mean that it needs to be the exception all the time. They are already setting very clear and important examples for the rest of the Arab world. In fact, they are setting another clear example where according to the polls, if elections are held tomorrow morning in Tunisia, the Islamists will actually lose to a coalition of secular forces, making the point that it is not always necessary, as many people have said before, that the Islamists, once they come to power, will not leave except by force. If that takes place, I think it will be a very important lesson to the rest of the Arab world.
And emulation throughout this history is very important. That is the way one Arab country sees what's going on elsewhere and decides whether it should be a model or not.
Well, the Arab uprisings have proved, basically, that no Arab country is immune, that what started in Tunisia did not stay in Tunisia, and quickly spread to Egypt, Libya, Syria, Yemen. So whereas, of course, every country has its own set of characteristics, but it is a region where emotions resonate across the Arab world.
The elephant in the room, which we need to talk about, is the efforts over time that have failed to achieve peace between the Palestinians and Israel, and then the Arab view of that happening. If your ideal were to be realized, namely pluralism, slowly with patience, emerging in these various Arab countries, what does this tell us about the need for there to be some sort of a solution to the Palestine-Israel conflict?
Well, it's crucial. You cannot talk about pluralism while there is an occupation. This is crucial. So for pluralism to be exercised, for people to feel they are equal, whether they are Muslims, Christians, or Jews, whether they are Israelis or Arab, the occupation has to end. And Palestinians have to feel that they have a state of their own, that they are conducting their own affairs.
But pluralism emerging in the Arab states, what will be their view if that doesn't happen with regard to the Israeli occupation?
I mean, no occupation in the world is popular, of course. But it's, of course, particularly unpopular in the Arab world because it happens that the people who are being occupied are Arabs, Palestinian Arabs. This is the longest occupation in the 20th century, 45 years and counting. It's the only occupation in the modern history of the world today. And it is basically a situation where Israel claims to be a democracy, but one, a democracy for its own people only. If you're a Jew, you know, you live in a democratic society. If you're not a Jew, you do not enjoy the same privileges. That, of course, cannot be the case. Once again, you cannot engage in selective pluralism, in selective democracy. Democracy has to apply equally to all. Pluralism has to apply equally to all. I'm worried about the future of the Arab-Israeli conflict. We have talked about a two-state solution, and there have been valiant efforts to bring such a solution about, of course, a solution that would meet both the needs of Palestinians and Israelis. But we are coming close to the point where a two-state solution is becoming almost impossible to implement. You have a situation in the West Bank today where the number of settlers in the West Bank and Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, has doubled from 250,000 at the time that we started the peace process in the early 90s to over 500,000 today. It is becoming almost impossible to separate the two communities and create a viable two-state solution. If this is not solved today, and I address that in the book, then I'm afraid we might go through a period where there is no solution and where people will start talking about other alternatives, including a one-state solution where everybody gets equal rights in the state they live in.
What should be the West, here especially the United States, with regard to furthering the idea of pluralism in the Arab world, the vision that you have? Is it a case where if we help too much, that will be a negative? Or if we should help, what exactly should we do and not be seen as interfering?
First of all, I think that this is largely a homegrown process. Interference anyway, whether it is done innocently or otherwise, is not going to produce results anytime soon. These things don't happen overnight. They happen after an evolution that is internal. The United States can do certain things and should not do other things it did in the past. In the past, it actually supported individuals, talked only to certain groups. These groups or individuals have proved to be autocrats that really did not have popular support. So in my view, first of all, the United States should support the process, but not individuals, should not take sides, should talk to all groups, should encourage the process, but not encourage the content of or take the sides of one group against another, etc. And understand that in the end, there are limits to what it can do. Economically, the United States cannot do what it used to do in the past because of the financial crisis it has. Politically, militarily, you know, the Iraq war has shown that military power has limits, and you cannot just create democracy in Iraq, for example, through simple military intervention. So there are limits to what it can do. But as long as I think, as I said, it understands that this needs time and it supports the process, I think it can help in such a way.
And what about the Palestine-Israel peace process? Does that require a position by the United States that thus far it hasn't been willing to take?
It requires an active participation and actually bridging the gap by putting a clear set of parameters on the table. If we leave that to the Palestinians and the Israelis, it is not going to be solved. The last round of negotiations is 20 years old, and I liken it to two people arguing over a slice of pizza while one of them is eating it. It doesn't work this way. The status quo is not frozen. It is being changed every day on the ground by building more settlements. And if we go on this track, it is never going to end. I think it's a clear case for intervention by the United States in putting on the table parameters and then in nudging the two sides to move towards an agreement. President Clinton did this in 2000. There is no reason why it cannot be done again. But to expect doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, as Einstein said, is just insanity.
Well, Marwan, I want to thank you for your book and actually for this very informative discussion. And I think you brought a different perspective on how we should view the second Arab awakening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.